Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 78th anniversary of the Enola Gay's fateful mission to Hiroshima by catching up with one of our last surviving connections to that chapter in history, 98-year-old Norris Jernigan of Visalia, California. I had the privilege of watching the new film Oppenheimer with Norris this week, and we'll get some final thoughts about that before we're done. When we left off, he was a teenager sworn to secrecy about a new secret weapon his 393rd Bomb Squadron had been told would shorten World War II by at least 2 years. So how much of an idea did they have about what that secret weapon might be?
Being in the Army Air Corps, we assumed it was some kind of a bomb because that was the only weapon the Air Force was using, mm-hmm. was bombs. So we assumed that it was some new type of explosive that would be used. Little did we know. Maybe some of the guys had college physics, maybe a higher education, figured out that it might be that. I certainly didn't. I had no knowledge of anything of that area, mm-hmm. of what it might be, but I just trusted that it was a new type bomb that we'd be using and would shorten the war. And of course, that was the goal of everybody, was mm-hmm. just get that war over, because it was such a nasty, bloody war out there in the Pacific, and Europe too, as far as that goes. And we understood after the fact, I guess it was after we even got back from overseas, the original plan was to put this group together and then split it in half, send half of it to Europe and half of it to the Pacific, and simultaneously drop two atomic bombs, mm-hmm. one on Germany and one on Japan. With the war winding down in Europe, because it was so close to being over by the time we were ready to go overseas in spring of 1945, if that was the plan, it was abandoned because we all went over to the island of Tinian.
But I'm sure there are a lot of fascinating months in between there. And before we hear about some of the things you experienced at Wendover and what it was like to go over to Tinian, how about explaining to us what your duties were? What were you responsible for on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I was assigned to the intelligence office as a clerk, intelligence clerk, which meant I typed reports and I helped put together folders made up of maps and aerial photographs and whatever else you could put in the folder to help them complete their mission. Then when they would come back from their mission, they were always interviewed and interrogated, and then I would type up the interrogation report. So a good part of it at first was just typing. My assignment, once we were overseas, the Squadron Intelligence Office was combined with the 509th Group Intelligence Office so that we were just one large office. And Lieutenant Jim Hinchy, who was part of the 393rd Squadron, was assigned the duty of Air Sea Rescue Officer. And his portion of the briefings for crews that would be flying missions would to brief them on the Air Sea Rescue. And he kind of adopted me as his assistant to help him with that. And so I would spend quite a bit of time working with him to put together information on where the submarines were operating and where the fleets were operating and where any amphibian planes might be operating. Because we received a teletype every day. Many people don't know what a teletype is. Back then we didn't have computers, so it was a teletype that we received either from the wing command or island command, I don't remember which now, that gave the location of all of these things, the submarines and the fleets and the amphibian planes, so that we could put together information for them that when they would fly their mission, when they would leave Japan, if they were shot up and knew they were going to have to ditch in the ocean, if you can fly to this longitude, latitude, go ahead and put out your distress call and ditch in the ocean, you'll be picked up. So we had that information to put together for that briefing. So that was my main responsibility once we were overseas to work with him.
Well, and I'm just imagining, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm thinking about all the guys I've talked to over the years, and so many of them, they only know what they're experiencing. You know, they know their mission, or if they're on the ground, they know, you know, this situation, this fight, this foxhole, this battle. If you're typing all these reports, you probably have more of a view of the big picture than most people in your squadron.
Yes, that would be a good assessment of that, yes. Not the complete knowledge. We never referred to these bombs as atomic bombs until after the first one was dropped. To us, it was the gimmick or the gadget that we referred to.
And I'm interested in some of the things that were happening there at Wendover, because again, we know now when the bomb was dropped and when the second bomb was dropped and everything that happened as a result. But at the time, you guys don't know anything, and this is all uncharted territory. So what was happening at Wendover, and what did you experience there?
When we went into trading there, they started sending the crews to a different site to do their practice bombing missions because they were using a heavier bomb than what the normal bomb would be. Somewhere down on the Southern California desert, when the crews would disappear for a few days, when they'd appear back at Wendover, where you guys been? Well, we were at Destination X or Destination Y. That's all. You didn't ask anything further than that. When the 509th was made up, it only had one bomb squadron, and the 393rd was it. There were other squadrons in the 509th. Each had their function. You didn't talk to anybody in the other squadrons because you never knew who you were talking to. Just an interesting note, when we arrived at Wendover, there was an elderly lady, Miss Merrill, on the base that was in charge of the furnishings for all of the day rooms. Well, it just so happened that the barracks that we had been put in, the group that I was with, it went into the barracks was a room that we thought we could convert that into our own day room. We were told we'll have to deal with Miss Merrill because she's in charge of the day rooms. So we did, and we were able to furnish that and have our own day room. She was just a grandmotherly type, lovable person, loved everybody, and we were her grandchildren, and she talked to us, and so friendly. You go over to her apartment, and, oh, you have to sit down and have a cup of iced tea. Yeah, we all loved Mom Merrill. That's what we referred to as Mom Merrill. One day she wasn't there anymore. Nobody knew where she was. Later on, we found out that she was actually FBI. She wasn't what she was supposed to be at all, you know.
She was there to keep an eye on you.
Yeah. So there again, you realize, gosh, I don't know if I ever said anything to her I shouldn't have or not. But, you know, she was so friendly and such a sweet little lady. But we didn't find that out until years later that actually that's what happened to her, that she was FBI and she was moved on.
Does that make you wonder if there are more revelations that could still take place, that you could still find out something that none of you have ever heard before?
Yes, I'm sure of it.
And what about the development of this weapon? Was there any awareness at all of things being tested, of capabilities being learned?
Not at my level. Colonel Tibbetts, of course, he was at the very beginning, he was given the task of putting together a military unit that could drop this special bomb. He knew about the bomb. He visited Los Alamos, and he was in touch with people higher up than him. So he knew about it, and maybe Colonel Payette, the group intelligence officer, he may have known too, but very few people knew what it was. As far as the development, I had no idea where it was being developed, and neither did any of the rest of the guys either, as far as I know. No idea where this thing was being developed. We didn't even know that they were going to test that one on the New Mexico desert on July 16th of 1945. Didn't even know that they had tested one until after the two bombs were dropped. Then we found out, well, yeah, they had tested the plutonium bomb.
So when you get the word, we're heading overseas, what did that mean for you?
Excitement. We thought, well, finally, we're going to get this thing done that we're supposed that we've been brought here to do. And so, yeah, we were all excited about getting over there. And I went over on board ship, and I wasn't one of the few that got to fly over with the B-29s, and we had a troop carrier squadron as part of the 509th also that flew C-54s, four-engine transport. So they transported a lot of the people. So, yeah, I was excited about getting, let's get over there and get this thing done. When I first got there, the crews arrived, started flying some practice missions with conventional bombs, that flying over to Marcus Island or somewhere, testing their accuracy for dropping any bomb. Then, in July, got word that they would start flying missions to Japan. So they started flying what we call the pumpkin bombs, which was the housing that was used for the plutonium bomb, really, with was full of TNT. The thing was a 10,000-pound bomb, did a lot of damage when it was dropped, but it still wasn't the gimmick. Well, after a couple of weeks of that type of mission, we began to wonder, well, maybe this is the thing. Is it a big flop as far as I was concerned? It just, you know, it's a big bomb. It did a lot of damage, but you know, with only one bomb. Well, the B-29, not ours, but the others, were equipped to put multiple bombs in their bomb bays. You load a B-29 up full of conventional bombs. If you dropped all of those bombs on a target, it would do as much damage or more than what these one TNT bombs were doing. When President Truman, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin met in Potsdam for the Potsdam Conference, they call it, they put together what was called the Potsdam Proclamation, directed to the Japanese Empire, demanding that they surrender unconditionally. And the Japanese received it, reviewed it, and on July 29th formally rejected it. They wanted to fight on. So that's at the point, I guess, that President Truman finally decided, all right, go ahead and use the atomic bombs.
I've always been amazed by the fact that he didn't even know about the Manhattan Project or about these nuclear capabilities until Roosevelt died and he became president, right?
Exactly. When he was sworn in, he had no knowledge of the atomic bomb project. And Stimson called him aside and clued him in. And that was the first he heard about. And I think that's a tragedy, that a man stands in the wings that's going to step in as president if something happens to the president, was denied knowledge of what's going on. You know, what in the world thinking is that?
I guess that underscores how secretive this whole thing was.
Even so,
yeah,
there were people that knew about it. Of course, Roosevelt knew about it because he's the one that instigated the startup of studying the use of uranium for that type of purpose. Others knew about it. Stimson knew about it. General Groves was headed up the atomic bomb project. General Hap Arnold knew about it. A lot of people knew about it. But the vice president of the United States is the second most important person in our government. And he was denied the knowledge of it, which just did not make sense. And I have never been able to understand the thinking of not briefing him on what's going on, because Roosevelt's health was getting so bad that they just expected him to drop dead any time, you know. They knew he was not going to be able to serve another 4 years. His health would not hold up that long. They knew that Harry Truman was going to become the president. And you don't clue the guy in? My gosh.
And it adds to the respect we have for how difficult that decision must have been for a guy who this is all new information to, and he's so new to the job.
Yes.
For you, out on Tinian, so you're a 20-year-old kid. This is your first time overseas.
Yes.
What was it like there? And I'm interested in what you shared a second ago, that as they're dropping these pumpkin bombs, there's some scuttlebutt, oh, maybe that's what the gadget's been the whole time, the gimmick, this is it.
Yes.
How did that all kind of unfold for you, and what was life like so far away from home for you?
Well, you know, I had my 20th birthday in June of 1945, so I was just barely 20 years old when these bombs were dropped. You know, it was exciting. When we first arrived there, we were put in a tent area, which was okay. We survived in the tent area, and we were a few weeks in the tent area when all of a sudden we were told the whole group was going to be moving into other facilities, and they moved us into what had been the CB's unit housing, which was all Quonset huts, very nice ones, and a very nice layout camp. It was complete. It had everything. It had a chapel, it had a theater, it had offices, it had barracks, it had a big mess hall. When we moved from the tent area to the Quonset hut area, life was nice. You know, I really enjoyed my time on Tinian because I knew I was a part of something big. Plus, it wasn't all that bad. When we got off the ship, at first, they didn't have any place for us, so we were living in pup tents for a few days. And that was pretty rugged, spread out in what used to be a cane field. It had been a farm. The civilians that lived on the island of Tinian, farmers, used human feces as their fertilizer. So we were told, don't eat any of the cane. Don't chew any of that cane. It could be harmful to you. But every day it would rain. You could just depend on it. Be bright, bright sunshine, and all of a sudden one cloud would seem to come up, and all of a sudden it would just pour down rain. Then all of a sudden the cloud would move on, the sun would come out again. Then the steam starts rising from the soil. So you could just imagine the odor that came with it. So it was rather unpleasant. But that didn't last too long, so we survived it. And then we went into the regular tent area that was, tents were spread on platforms, so we were up off the ground and on wood floors at least. And then from there to the Quonset Hut area. But we weren't too popular when we hit Tinian. We showed up over there with all kinds of priorities. 15 B-29s with no armor and no gun turrets, with all kinds, like I say, all kinds of priorities that the other guys had been over there for months slushing around in the mud and the slush and air crews flying missions and being shot down. And here this bunch of pansies show up with 15 airplanes with just a tail gun, two 50 caliber tail guns. Right away they wanted to know what we were up to, and nobody could tell them anything. So there was all kinds of scuttlebutt around the island about what that group was all about. And one guy even wrote a poem about the 509th is winning the war. After August 6th, the tone changed because they realized we did have a mission over there after all.
What was August 6th like for you?
Oh, it was exciting. Around August 1st, we realized that things were starting to happen because all of a sudden people started showing up. A lot of people in khaki uniforms with no military insignia, which meant they weren't military. Civilians showing up. A lot of high-ranking officers showing up. Even a naval officer showing up. What in the world is the Navy doing here? So we knew that things were happening because of all these secret meetings all of a sudden that only certain people were allowed to go in. We had a military police squadron as well in the group. You know, it just wouldn't be anything to notice that on the chapel, one of the MPs, one on either side of the door, standing there with their weapons, just guarding the door. That meant there was a secret meeting going on in there. And a lot of the briefings were held in there. There were several briefings, and they were held at different places, but the main ones, I think, used the little chapel, which was another Quonset hut converted into a chapel. So we knew that things were starting to happen. So we had a lot of excitement. All these high-ranking officers showing up. It was funny. One day, a group of us were just sitting around talking with some of these new people that had shown up, and I was sitting next to this person that was quite a bit older than me, but we were just having a good conversation, and I just happened to turn around and look on, and on his collar was a star. He was a general, General Farrell, and that was where I met General Farrell, just sitting talking to him. He was just a regular guy, you know. Anyhow, we knew that things were starting to happen, and then when the mission was scheduled, we knew that it was the big one.
How did you know?
That was the information we got in the intelligence office, that the bomb is here. It's going to be delivered. August 6th was selected as the date, and Colonel Tibbetts was going to fly the airplane. So he took over the crew of Captain Lewis, and Captain Lewis had to move over to the co-pilot seat. That was the privilege of the commanding officer. If he wanted to fly the airplane, the normal airplane commander would move over and become co-pilot. But anyhow, it was determined that Colonel Tibbetts was going to be the airplane commander on that mission. Then all these secret briefings we knew were briefing for this big mission that was going to happen. And we were all sitting around the office. All the briefings had been completed, and we knew that they were going to be taking off that night, sometime after midnight of August 6th, and sitting around in the intelligence office waiting to go down to the flight line and see them off. And my buddy Ed Schlesinger and I, who had the same capacity jobs in the intelligence office, we were buddies as well. We were getting so heavy-eyed and about to go to sleep, our sergeant finally said, "Hey, you guys are you're going to go to sleep here. Why don't you go on back to the Quonset Hut, lay down. As soon as we get ready to go down to the flight line, I'll come get you." Well, that was good news for us, so we went dashing off to the barracks to the Quonset Hut. Flopped down on the bed. When I opened my eyes, it was the next morning. He didn't come get us, so we missed the takeoff. Anyhow, they took pictures that night. It was a big affair. They had floodlights down there, and they were recording, talking to the crew members, and, of course, Colonel Tibbetts. The crew got in the airplane. They cranked up the engines and just started moving to taxi out to the runway, and Colonel Tibbetts opened the side window and leaned out and waved. Well, when I saw that picture, I thought, I've got to have my picture taken the same way. So a few days later, after that mission, some of us from the intelligence office took the office jeep and went down to the flight line. And so I had my picture taken looking out the window of Enola Gay.
You can find that photo at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, more reflections from Norris Jernigan about that chapter of history, receiving more attention this weekend because of the 78th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, also coinciding with the release of the feature film, Oppenheimer. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.